welcome to the 12th lecture on Scottish literature. The strike is still on at USPI, so I'm asking you to settle back at home, perhaps open a packet of shortbread, perhaps pour yourself a nice little dram of whiskey. There you go. All the better to enjoy the lecture, which looks at the consolidation of stereotypes towards the end of the 19th century, stereotypes that later became known as Kailyard writing, and images of tartanry. So if we move to the first slide, you'll see that the rise of Kailyard fiction and drama is something that happened really towards the end of the 19th century, and it created images and formulae for representing Scottishness that lasted well into the 20th and indeed the 21st century. And there in the corner of the slide you can see one of the great exponents of early 20th century culture internationally, a music hall entertainer known as Sir Harry Lauder. The next slide shows us some of the background to Kailyard and tartanry at the end of the 19th century. One of the things that happens in this period is the rise of English literature as a respectable form of academic study. Before this, in universities and in serious cultural commentary, English literature wasn't really seriously thought about. But towards the end of the 19th century, and indeed beginning in some of the Scottish universities, as the critic Robert Crawford has shown in The Invention of English Literature, English literature began to be seen as a serious subject of study. And those who began to talk seriously about English literature, people like Matthew Arnold, a poet and cultural critic, wrote about it in terms of culture and anarchy, the title of Arnold's great book of 1869. And Arnold is quoted on the PowerPoint slide saying that culture is a study of perfection. It seeks to do away with classes, to make the best that had been thought and known in the world current everywhere, to make all men live in an atmosphere of sweetness and light. And this is, of course, what we do in departments of English. We seek to make the best that has been thought and known in the world current everywhere, to make all men live in an atmosphere of sweetness and light. And it's that kind of idea that this is what literature should do that begins to inform literary study at the end of the 19th century, and consequently begins to marginalise certain kinds of Scottish literature. If we move on to the next slide, we can see the critic Robin Gilmore talking about the results of Arnold's formulation of culture. He says, "Arnold's formulation of culture as a transcendent value is a crucial development because it drove a wedge between regionalism and culture, stigmatizing the one as enfeebled provincialism and raising the other above the claims of time and place." That's an article by Robin Gilmore in a book called The Literature of Region and Nation, edited by Draper. Now, the argument here is that the kind of novel that we've seen John Galt writing, and even the kind of historical romance that Walter Scott famously initiated, this began to be seen as not the kind of thing that culture should be doing. Culture is universal. Culture is transcendent. Culture gives the best that has ever been thought, makes that available everywhere. And if you're regional, if you're Scottish, then you can't really be transcendent if you're stuck in a particular time and place. So, as Gilmore says, there's a wedge driven between regional novels, in this case Scottish novels, and the notion of culture, because culture is universal. So this causes a problem, as we can see in our next slide, for those writers who became increasingly associated with provincial novels in Scotland towards the end of the 19th century. They were tremendously popular in their day. They're represented by people like Ian McLaren, who wrote Beside the Bonnie Briar Bush, S.R. Crockett, who wrote The Stickit Minister, and the person we'll be concentrating on today, James M. Barrie, J.M. Barrie, who wrote Auld Licht Idylls, A Window in Thrums, and other books. Now, what unites these writers is they are the kind of heirs of John Galt. They took the provincial novel in Scotland, they wrote happy little novels about regional life in the Scottish countryside in small town Scotland, populated them with interesting and funny characters, and they were incredibly popular. People read these in droves. But in the context of what people like Matthew Arnold were saying about culture being transcendent and universal, people began to be increasingly uneasy about these as emblems, as tokens of universal culture. They were very formulaic, as you can see in the next slide. They became associated with particular attributes. They were domestic rather than industrial or professional. They took place in the home. They were rustic rather than urban. They took place in small town Scotland. They were full of farmers rather than industrial workers. They were funny. And the people who were funny tended to be the relatively uneducated but clever rustic labourers. They might not be educated, but they were clever or canny in another way. There were various values that were endorsed by these novels, the values of humility, modesty, decency, piety. Also, poverty and that kind of sly humour that in Scotland we call canniness. And there were various characters who appeared again and again. The minister was one, the heirs of Micah Bulwhidder. There's the dominie, which was the Scottish word for the teacher, the doctor and the lawyer. There was usually somebody from the professional classes who worked as the interpreter or the mediator between the reader and the rustic, comic, working class, peasant characters that populated the novels. Now, people like Andrew Nash have recently written books like Kailyard and Scottish Literature that try to revive interest in the Kailyard as a critical genre. But it's true that from fairly early on, critics were quite negative about Kailyard. And this included, as we can see in the next slide, critics like Margaret Oliphant, whose Library Window we looked at a couple of weeks ago. In Blackwood's magazine in 1889, she wrote criticising the general school of Kailyard. She says the books called Carlowry, Alderside, Blinkbonny, Glenearley, etc. are cheap books, perfectly well adapted with their mild love stories and abundant marriages for the simpler classes, especially of women, whose visions are bounded by the parish, who know nothing higher in society than the minister and his wife, and believe that all the world lieth in wickedness, except Scotland. It is sad to be told that these productions are regarded as representatives of a national school and attain their popularity by dint of their dialect and the very narrowness of their aim. So there you've got Margaret Oliphant regretting the fact that these Kailyard novels are seen to be representative of a national or a Scottish school. And the reason why she regrets this is that they are narrow in scope. They are not transcendent. They do not live up to Matthew Arnold's idea that culture should be universal. But as we can see in the next slide, maybe Oliphant and Arnold had a point. By the end of the 19th century, Kailyard novels do not really represent what Scotland has been going through. If you take a look at John Galt's The Annals of the Parish, you can see that actually it's quite an interestingly accurate critique and satire on attitudes during a very interesting period of Scottish history. It tries to dramatise changes that are taking place in the Industrial Revolution, the Napoleonic Revolutions, changes in attitude towards politics, changes in attitude towards the landed gentry. By the time you get to Galt's heirs at the end of the 19th century, they tend to be exploiting the provincial location of Kailyard Nuvilles, small town Scotland, for their comic effect. Instead of being a political or a social critique, the Nuvilles are an escape from an increasing industrial reality. By the end of the 19th century, the reality for most Scots is represented by the photograph that you can see in the left hand of the screen, Jamaica Bridge in Glasgow, the bridge leading down to the docks where the tobacco ships go to the Americas. But the city, Glasgow, the industrial reality, is not what is being represented in the National School of Scottish Novels. The National School, as you can see in the postcard on the right-hand side, is represented by small towns like Kirriemuir, which is the birthplace of J.M. Barrie, and the inspiration for his novel A Window in Thrums and Auld Licht Idylls. So, while many Scots are now living in cities, experiencing industrial reality, the Nuvilles still pretend that small town Scotland is the norm. As the next slide shows, the representative, probably the best representative of Kailyard writing, the best writer of the school, is J.M. Barrie, who was born in 1860, died in 1937. So he kind of bestrides the end of the 19th century like a colossus. He does grow up in small town Scotland. He's born in Kirriemuir in Angus in the northeast of Scotland. When he's 6 years old, his brother David dies, which is a traumatic event which many people said scarred him for life. And when he was a child, growing up in Kirriemuir, he developed an interest in storytelling. He then went to one of the two major Scottish cities, Edinburgh, studied literature at Edinburgh University, and started writing drama criticism for an Edinburgh newspaper. He then worked as a journalist before taking up writing full-time. And his first novels are based on his childhood in Kirriemuir. Auld Licht Idylls, A Window in Thrums, and The Little Minister are all based on Kirriemuir. Kirriemuir is the fictional Thrums. They were popular successes, and they allowed Barrie to begin to indulge his interest in drama, and he began writing plays. And in 1904, he wrote the play for which he's best remembered, Peter Pan, and that's produced in London. And it's the first of a number of extremely successful plays. The next slide shows the Hollywood representation of J.M. Barrie. On the left-hand side, you've got a photograph of the man himself. On the right-hand side, you've got a photograph of Barrie as represented by Johnny Depp. And definitely, when I grow up, I want to be played by Hollywood, by Johnny Depp in Hollywood too. In Andrew Nashe's Kailyard and Scottish Literature, which is quoted in the next slide, Nash argues that there is a change in Barrie's writing as he develops as a writer, as he moves from being a novelist to a dramatist. He says at this stage of his career, the early stage, the stage of A Window in Thrums and Auld Licht Idylls, he uses the narrator to try to convince the reader of the realism and veracity of the story, and of Jess and her family, and the emotions involved in it. As his fictional career progressed, however, he became more interested in the role of the narrator and in the act of creating illusions of reality. His later novels are characterized by an intense interest in the creative mind, with storytelling and illusory realities. And you can, of course, see this in Peter Pan. You can see it also in some of the later plays. But the early novels, the Cale Yard novels, are interested in a kind of social realism. And the narrator is there, as I said earlier, to mediate between the reader and the characters in the novel. And in the passage that I gave you from A Window in Thrums, you can see the way that Barry represents the characters, the comic characters, in his novel. In this little chapter, the narrator is having a conversation with Tammas in the pigsty in Kirriemuir, or Thrums. And Tammas is telling the narrator about his great plan to build a home for geniuses. Geniuses need to be protected. They need to be protected from the difficulties of the world. So you need to build a home for them. You'd build it near London, obviously, because that's the centre of civilization. You wouldn't build it in Ayr or Kirriemuir. And you'd allow members of the public to pay to look at the geniuses' thinking. And the narrator asks Tammas if he's thinking of living geniuses only, and he responds to him, as he normally speaks, Tammas, in Scots. "Aye," he said thoughtfully, "them that's gone canna be brought back. Weel, my idea is that a home should be built for geniuses at the public expense, where they could all live together and be decently looked after. Nah, no in London, that's no my plan, but I would hae it within an hour's distance of London, say 5 mile frae the marketplace, and standing in a big garden where the geniuses could walk about, arm in arm, composing their minds." So you can see here that Tammas has a view of London, a very rustic view of London, as being basically a big village around a marketplace, and about 5 miles from the marketplace, which Tammas imagines being an hour's distance from London, you would have your home for geniuses, and you could watch the modern-day descendants of Rabbi Burns sitting around having great thoughts. So this is part of the charm, part of the naivety that is celebrated in Cale Yard novels. And one of the things that I asked you to do was to think about how this might be translated into Portuguese. And in the next slide, you've got one of the possibilities that Sabrina submitted, and I'm not even going to try to read this, because my Portuguese accent is bad enough, my Caipira Portuguese is even worse. But I've highlighted in red on this slide the way that Sabrina has tried to transform the rural Scots accent and dialect of Tammas into basically what I understand to be a kind of caipira. And you can see it in the R sound in Voltaire. You can see it in the pronunciation of bon as ba. And you can see it in the transformation of words like dissentimenti as dissentimenti, I don't know. And that's a very nice, very, I think, successful adaptation of Barry Scots into something that is non-standard Portuguese. But as I said in my feedback to this activity, there are issues which Sabrina very nicely raises. I was very pleased to see this kind of translation going on. Other people did other things. Some people tried it in a kind of Mozambique Portuguese, and some people had a slightly more just colloquial Portuguese with lots of kind of spoken expressions rather than written language. But the act of trying to translate Scots dialect into Portuguese raises all sorts of questions about the Scots. What's it actually doing? Is this a representation of Angus speech, the part of the world where Barry grew up? Well, actually, if you take a look at it, it's not. It is actually an artificial literary dialect, which some of you worried about when you were doing your translations. Am I writing in an authentic voice, or am I writing an artificial literary dialect? Barry is actually writing in an artificial literary Scots. It's much more of a traditional Scots that he finds in other books, rather than an accurate representation of the speech of the people that he grows up around. And there's also a problem about the attitude that we take to this kind of accent, to this kind of dialect, when we read it. If you're translating the Scots into a kind of post-colonial variety of Portuguese, what's the attitude to that post-colonial variety? Is it legitimate to laugh at it? If you're reading this in a Caipira accent, is the immediate instinct to laugh? What does that tell us about linguistic prejudices? What does it tell us about social prejudices? And exactly the same questions can be asked about Barry. Is he playing into, and are the his fellow Caillard writers playing into the hands of linguistic and social prejudice? If you're a Scots writer, is it your fate, is it your destiny, never to be taken seriously? To be funny, cute, but not intellectual. So these are the kind of questions, these are the kind of worries that Caillard fiction begins to excite in the critical consciousness. Now, as I say, despite the critics' anxieties about Caillard, it did find its audience. It was incredibly popular. It was popular not just in Scotland, it was hugely popular in England, and it was incredibly popular, as we can see in the next slide, in the United States. Barry toured the eastern coast of the United States. He went to New York and Boston in 1897. And the cartoon that you can see in Life magazine of January 1897 shows Barry being lauded in Boston. This particular cartoon is in Boston. And you can see this image of Barry in a horse-drawn carriage in this huge parade that is celebrating him and has even got banners there in some kind of artificial parody of Scots. What it says is "Wha sic a wa gin bro hootu hoot." It doesn't mean anything, but it's an American representation of Barry's artificial Scots. And it's an article in which Barry is parodied as Donald McSlushy, and it questions the Americans' celebration, their uncritical celebration of all things Scottish. And in the next slide, you can see my favourite excerpt from the article about parody. About halfway through it, about halfway down the second column in this page, you can see that J.M. Barrie's lectures in America are being parodied. Barrie is, of course, Mr. McSlushy. And the satirist, the anonymous author of this article, says that Mr. McSlushy's lecture at the music hall was a marvel of eloquence. His subject was the all-round superiority of Scotland, and it electrified the biggest audience of modern times. In the course of his remarks, he said, "And why is Scotland so far ahead of all the rest of Christendom? She has never produced a great painter, sculptor, or musician. Her climate is cold and damp, while the salient features of her national costume are a scanty skirt and naked knees. Her music is the bagpipe. Her language, if you can call it such, is the harshest that ever shattered the tympanum of man. Yet why? Why, although America, for instance, is swamped beneath a tidal wave of Scotch authors, Scotch literature and dialect, why is it, I ask, that we never tire of it?" At this point, a voice from the rear of the hall answered, "But we do." The words were no sooner uttered, however, than furious women threw themselves upon the brute and tore him into fragments. So again, you can see at the height of Barry's international success, there are critical voices saying this is all just slush, this is sentimental nonsense, this is an aberration. And that view of Caillard began to be the critical norm. It didn't stop people writing Caillard, though. Caillard succeeded in conquering America even later in the day. The next slide shows a review in a magazine called Current Literature, another American magazine, in January 1912, over a decade after the Life magazine article. And it's talking about the success of a really terrible Scottish play called Bunty Pulls the Strings, a very sentimental play in quite strong Scots dialect. If you look in the Moodle site, you can see the full article with a large extract from the play itself. It's a very sentimental play. It went to America in 1912, and it was a great success. And the review that is here contrasts it favourably with the Irish players from the Abbey Theatre in Dublin, who had a limited success. But the Scotch players from Glasgow, in this little sentimental drama called Bunty Pulls the Strings, were a tremendous success. So the influence of Kailyard and popular culture survived Barry and indeed stretched well into the 20th century. And what I want to do now for the last few minutes of this lecture is reflect upon both the enduring success of Kailyard and its visual counterpart, which we come to call tartanry.
The next slide shows some of the literary and televisual impact of Kailyard. In the 1930s, the Scottish author A.G. Crone wrote a novella called Country Doctor. And it's pure Kailyard. It's about a doctor called Dr. Finlay who goes to small town Scotland, and he has a series of episodic adventures which involve amusing local people. It was a great success, and in the 1960s the BBC recorded a series called Dr. Finlay's Casebook based on Country Doctor, and it ran for 9 years from 1971, and I remember growing up watching this on television. It was revived in 1993 to 1996, and people fondly remember Dr. Finlay's Casebook. And it was filmed first of all in the town of Callander in Scotland, and the later series was in Auchtermuchty, and both these places lay claim to being the location, Tannachbrae, the fictional location of Dr. Finlay's Casebook. And certainly if you go to Callander, even today you can buy postcards, even today you can buy postcards celebrating the fact that it was the location of Dr. Finlay's Casebook. So you can see in literature and television the influence of Kailyard lasted well into the 20th century. There's the influence of Kailyard on film as well. There are films like Whiskey Galore, based on Compton Mackenzie's novel of the 1940s, and more modern films like Local Hero from the 1980s with Burt Lancaster revisit Kailyard from a slightly ironic perspective, and it's but basically it's the same Kailyard stereotypes that were being celebrated in these movies. In Local Hero, which is well worth watching, we've given a YouTube link to the whole film. An American capitalist comes to Scotland. He wants to destroy the small Scottish town to build an oil refinery, but he's ultimately seduced by the small town values that he comes to be aware of and comes to fall in love with as he encounters the magical aura of Kailyard, Scotland. Local Hero is a very annoying film. A number of Kailyard stereotypes are ironized, they're sent up. But basically, you still have the same Kailyard values of small town decency, humility, piety, wisdom being celebrated at the end of the movie as the capitalist Americans are enchanted by the otherworldly Scots. There are a number of films in this vein. As we move from literature to drama, to television, and to film, you can see that Kailyard begins to have a visual counterpart. And this is sometimes known as tartanry. You can see it in still images, in shortbread fingers, which some of you will be eating while you're listening to this and watching this in the PowerPoint slides. And like Kailyard, tartanry is associated with certain attributes. It's associated with Walter Scott and Walter Scott's Scottish patriotism is illustrated, it's attributed more than Caillard itself with nobility, with the landed gentry, and Walter Scott's kind of vision of romantic Scotland. It's associated with Highland ancestry and the kilt, and with sentimental Jacobitism. And its representatives tend to be people like Highland soldiers wearing the kilt, the noble savages that you find in the Highlands of Scotland. It's associated in the present day with the iconography of Scottish football fans. It's associated with musical entertainers like Sir Harry Lauder. And in latter-day films, I suppose the most famous representative is Mel Gibson in the role of Braveheart, William Wallace in Braveheart. It's an early stereotype, as you can see in the next slide. It exists certainly at the end of the 1700s in this tobacco advertisement that was printed in the north of England. It dates from 1790, and in the advertisement you can see a Scottish soldier. We know he's a soldier because when the advertisement was printed, it was still illegal to wear the kilt unless you were a soldier in the British Army. So here you've got a soldier taking snuff in full regimental outfit, and it's a tobacco product. You can see the tobacco on the right-hand side of the advertisement in the tobacco barrels, and on the left-hand side you can see a North American slave, a person of colour, and he is smoking a tobacco pipe. If you take a look at the slave and if you take a look at the soldier, you can see that they are linked visually by the feathers in their headdress. I can recognise everything in the Scottish outfit except the feathered headdress, and that's something that visually links the Scottish soldier and the American slave. So these are two people who are put visually into the same category, and that category is the exotic other. The idea, which is exactly the same as the Marlboro cowboy that some of you might remember from the Marlboro cigarette advertisements, is that if you take tobacco products, if you take snuff, if you smoke a pipe, if you smoke a cigarette, you become something else. You become an exotic, otherworldly, savage, a noble savage, if you like. A cowboy, a Scottish soldier, a black American slave. So this is the beginnings of the visual stereotypes that become associated with Tartary. Earlier we saw a picture of a photograph of Sir Harry Lauder. The next slide shows him in full outfit, and you can see how this translated into early 20th century popular culture. Lauder was born in 1870 as he toured Europe and America in the early 1900s. He died in 1950, a millionaire. He was one of the great. He was probably the most famous Scot alive in the early 1900s, and he toured in full Highland dress. There is a single feather in his cap, but you see there is not the full outfit that the full headdress that the Scottish soldier wears in the tobacco advertisement, but otherwise he has the visual formula that is associated with Highland dress and tartanry. So he is immediately visually identified as Scottish. If you take a look at the next slide, you can see the heirs of the Scottish soldier, the heirs of Harry Lauder today, are Scottish football fans. People don't dress up like this for local games. They only dress up like this for the national team. So here we've got some people dressed up in the visual iconography of Tartanry to support the national team. And if Scotland had been coming to Rio in 2014, Rio would have been flooded and São Paulo would have been flooded with people looking like this. The critics hated him. In books like The Eclipse of Scottish Culture, by Craig Beveridge and Ronald Turnbull, and in articles by people like Colin MacArthur, who talk about films like Brigandine, which is the Hollywood fantasy of Scotland, you can see people attacking Caillard and attacking Tartanry as inauthentic myths that come from outside of Scotland and are articulating a sense of inferiority. is a marvellous film. It's worth watching. The story of Brigadoon is that the producers came to Scotland looking for locations. They decided that Scotland did not look Scottish enough, and so they went back and made the entire film in Hollywood. And it is, from beginning to end, a catalogue of Kailyard and territory. The story is very similar to Local Hero. Two Americans, one played by Van Heflin, one played Van Johnson, one played by Jim Carrey, come to Scotland on holiday. They discover a little Scottish town that only appears once every 100 years. It's been cursed. Jim Carrey falls in love with a local girl, Sister Charisse. And the question is, does he go back to modernity, which is represented by America? Does he go back to the modern world? Or does he stay in Scotland, which is perpetually always in the past? So Scotland is associated with the past. America is associated with the modern. And that is a dilemma for the man that goes between the two worlds. He has to choose, as every Scot has to choose, between modernity and being Scottish. One of the saddest things that's happened in the last 10, 15 years is the success of Mel Gibson's Braveheart. If you go to Scotland now to the Wallace Monument in Stirling, at the base of the Wallace Monument, you will see that even now we imagine our Scottish heroes in Hollywood terms. At the base of the Wallace Monument in Stirling, where Wallace won his great battle, you will see a statue of Mel Gibson with the word Braveheart written on the shield. And this kind of typifies the Scottish inferiorism that Turnbull, Beveridge and MacArthur talk about. We cannot imagine our own local heroes anymore. We have to imagine our Scottish heroes in Hollywood terms as imposed externally. That's the argument of Scottish inferiorism.
Of what females should look like, or females in charge of their own representation.
ask the same questions about Scotland. You can ask questions about the interests that are served by the representations, whose interests are represented by the images that we get out of Kailyard. Are they there for the entertainment purely of a non-Scottish audience, or do they promote the interests of the Scottish communities that are represented? And do they turn Scottish culture and Scottish history and identity into a product for consumption? Can you go into a tourist shop, buy a Scottish kilt, buy some whiskey, and become Scottish? Do they serve up for tourist consumption an inauthentic Scotland? If they're not real, if they're magical, and Scotland is often represented post-Kailyard as magical. If they're anti-realist, if they're magical, are they therefore false? Or do they represent another kind of truth? If they're popular, and certainly if they're kitsch, are they therefore irredeemable? I do remember once being in the same room as Colin MacArthur, the critic who attacked Braveheart and attacked Tartanry and attacked Kailyard representations of Scotland. And we were in a kind of baronial castle in the bar drinking whiskey, watching the sun go down in Loch Lomond and the Scottish hills in the distance. And one of our colleagues turned to Colin and said, "Isn't it beautiful? It's a pity it's not real. There are real Scotlands out there that kind of conform to the stereotypes. Therefore, are they false? Are they irredeemable?" It's a complex set of issues. Anyway, that's Kailyard. What we'll do as we go into the final map, the last 3 or 4 weeks of the course, I can't remember how many weeks there are left, but I think there are 4. And if there are 4, these are the topics that we'll cover. In the next lecture, we'll take a look at the 20th century literary renaissance. What happens when the people who are producing the culture begin to react against the kind of stereotypes that we've been looking at today, when they react against the image of small-town Scotland, when they react against the cosy, decent, pious attitudes that are represented by Kailyard novels and Tartanry, when they react against Robert Burns and Walter Scott. We take a look at the people who react against the language and the attitudes of the Kailyard writers, people like Hubert Derwent, Edwin Muir, and Solomon MacLean. If we have time, and this is, if we only have 3 weeks, this might be the lecture that goes, but I would like to take a look at one of the great writers of 20th century Scotland, Muriel Spark, another woman. We wrote a novel called The Crime of Miss Jean Brodie, which was also filmed, but the book is much better than the film. The film's very good. It stars Maggie Smith. The Crime of Miss Jean Brodie is a wonderful revisiting of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde from the point of view of 1930s Edinburgh. And I used to use it with my Chinese students to suggest to them that education and their charismatic teachers are emblems of fascism. I would very much like to take a look at Edwin Morgan and the Avant-Garde. Edwin Morgan translated the De Campos brothers, particularly the concrete poetry of the De Campos brothers, into English. And I would like to take a look at Edwin Morgan, who's the most important poet of the second half of the 20th century. In some ways, he's the heir of Hugh MacDiarmid, although they had a difficult relationship. And Morgan very much became associated with the second half of the 20th century and a move away from the kind of modernism that MacDiarmid represented. And he was the first national poet of Scotland. So I'd like to take a look at Edwin Morgan and the Avant-Garde. And then finally, in the last lecture, I'd like to take a look at the end of the 20th century and the movement into the 21st century and the current wave of Scottish writing, represented by people like Evan Welsh, the author of Trainspotting, Liz Lochhead, the poet and dramatist, Alan Warner, who wrote Marvin Crowley, which was made into a very fine film, and Jackie Kay, who's perhaps one of the most interesting multicultural novelists, poets and dramatists of the present day. She had a Nigerian father, Scottish mother, adopted into a communist Glasgow family, Gaelic-speaking grandmother. She kind of typifies summarise everything that you want to know about 21st century Scotland. I'll leave it there with a tea towel and a map of Scotland. Thank you very much.